And welcome back to Coast with Robert Gleason as we continue chatting with him about the evil that men do. And we're going to take your phone calls as well. So jump on board on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Bob Gleason with us. The Evil That Men Do. The book just came out. And we're going to get to your calls as well. Bob, what would you say is your biggest concern facing us as Americans?
Let me just get my website in. www.robertgleasonbooks.com. Gleason is G-L-E-A-S-O-N. We were talking before about the rise of global oligarchy, including oligarchy in the United States. We mentioned in the U.S., three people have more money than 50% of the population, 0.1% more than 90% of the population. There is this movement toward, and you're talking before about the future and, you know, what are major concerns. You know, it always depends on the scenario. Our old friend Jerry Purnell used to say, I'd ask
him. God love him, huh?
Yeah, I loved him to death. Yeah. He passed away, unfortunately.
Yep.
He was, among many, many other things, he was also a futurologist. And I was always picking his brains about what do you think about the future. And he'd always say to me, Bob, you know, he'd talk like this and go, Bob, depends on the scenario. You know, it all depends on the scenario. And he was right. That was it. I can give you what some problems are, and I can give you a positive scenario. That one of the, we're talking about the rise of the global oligarchs. One of the two industries that have disproportionate influence on American politics, they really are oligopolies, which means they're industries that are dominated by six major companies each. And they spend enormous sums of money on buying political influence. And it's one is the financial sector, the other is the petrochemical sector. Do you know that worldwide, the global petrochemical sector and the financial sector, they receive from governments $6 trillion in government subsidies.
Jeez.
That's 8% of the global GDP. The World Bank has complained that it's pauperizing entire countries, and it's also to say nothing of it's turning countries into oligarchies and stuff. Well, in this country, that we're talking before about that what could be done, you know, to solve some problems. One big problem, of course, is we have a lot of problems with Iran, Saudi Arabia, Russia, and that. If we actually got the world off of oil as a major source of fuel, if we could free the world from Middle Eastern oil, from Russian oil, and you'd probably have to do it through alternate energy, but in 3 years, Saudi Arabia would be Somalia, Iran would be Afghanistan, and Putin, you know, if he was still around, would be living on a cold kasha and boiled potatoes.
Yeah, he'd take his billions and leave.
Oh, right? Yeah, but, you know, he one of the problems of a guy like Putin is you've got to have a small army around you in order to survive. He's hurt too many people.
That's true.
But, you know, suddenly that all those problems go away. You know, that with the same thing with the financial sector. You know that in the United States, 50% of all non-farm corporate profit goes to the financial sector. That they've become kind of like their own. They take more money out of this country than the IRS. And the companies are too big. Everybody says they're too big to fail. Well, break them up. That's what Theodore Roosevelt did. That's what FDR did. We know how to do these things. Get the world off of too much oil. We're spending $6 trillion a year on government subsidies for oil and for finding the financial
subsidies. $6 trillion?
Get the world off of, you know, break up the financial monopolies, get the world off of, you know, start developing alternate energies. Solar and wind are getting cheaper every year. And if we really worked, had a Manhattan Project to develop these alternate energies, that we could be free of oil and gas in a surprisingly short period of time. And of course, it would do great wonders for health. That it'd get rid of so much pollution. You know, the number one national security problem in China right now, it's not North Korea, it's not Russia, it's air pollution, water pollution. And that they have riots over this stuff. This is this stuff is not good for people. I grew up in a steel town near Gary, Indiana, that it's a cancer cluster. I've got about 24 friends back home. 20 of them have had cancer. And it's because of the air and the water.
It's got to be.
And that stuff's no good for us anyway. It's time to get on to clean energy.
Let's take some health, and it
will solve our major geopolitical problems at the same time. Let me just say one more thing. You know how how Sherman and Sheridan defeated the Plains Indians? They never defeated them in the field. But they did something that was really pretty ruthless. They killed the bison. By the year 1900, there are fewer than 1,000 bison left in.
They killed their food source.
Yeah, they killed the food. They killed their sustenance. That if we want to get rid of our problems with Russia and the Middle Eastern terrorist states, that you get rid of their bison. Well, they don't have bison, but they have petrodollars. You take their petrodollars away from them. As I said, in 3 years, that Saudi Arabia would be Somalia and that Iran would be Afghanistan, and all our problems go away. But the problem is the petrochemical and sector and financial sectors, they've got too much political clout in this country. Now, if we address those problems and we take care of them, you know, suddenly, overnight, we've got, among other things, we wouldn't have to spend so much money on national defense. I mean, it would be, we could turn this country into a utopia.
We could. It's a big, you have to quote that.
Yeah.
All right, let's go to the phone. Steve in Pennsylvania to get us started. Hi, Steve, go ahead.
Hello. The financial aspect is really the biggest issue in the temporal order. And once a nation loses control of its money and credit, it then loses its control over the media. And without those two things being sovereign, independent, there's really no chance for any substantial and sustained reform. It's like one great monetary reformer had said, all other questions, all other reforms begin with monetary reform. So why do we wait to reform money?
Well, the last time I looked, there were $1.4 quadrillion. That's $quadrillion with a Q.
Too many zeros.
Global derivative debt in the world today. That's $1.4 quadrillion. Now, to say that that's not a bubble and that bubble isn't going to burst is fundamentally childish. I mean, we had a debt derivative bubble that burst. It was called the subprime mortgage fiasco. And that's going to burst one day. It'll pretty much destroy the world when it does.
It'll happen again.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, it'll make the 1929 World Depression, which, by the way, was created by Wall Street, let no one forget, just as the 2008 World Global Depression was created by Wall Street. You know, we will create the global derivative crash, and it's going to make those previous crashes look like a day at the beach.
Next up, Wayne in Chicago. Hi, Wayne. Go ahead.
Thank you again, George.
Sure thing.
Yes. I want to make a couple of comments, then I want to ask your guest a question.
Okay.
First, he was talking about the Ukraine and Crimea. The Russians really only went into the Ukraine because the Ukrainians were slaughtering the Russians and the Russian-speaking people. And also in Crimea, 9 out of 10 people voted to join Russia rather than stay with Ukraine. But my question is, what do you think about Netanyahu's presentation where he said that he had definitive proof that Iran had nuclear weapons, because Macron of France said the same thing? He came over here. He even did a joint session of Congress, showed us absolutely no proof. I say Netanyahu is wrong because the Germans, the British, they also say that the IAEA, or however way you say it, they have thorough, very good inspection procedures, and on those military installations also. So what do you think, sir?
You're absolutely right. The Netanyahu, there's been a lot of analyses of what this. He wasn't talking about anything current. He was talking about a program that Iran had back in 2003 that they voluntarily disbanded. Had never, so it was a nuclear weapons program. They disbanded and never started up again. They did it of their own free will. He was trying to make, it was a very slippery speech. He was trying to make it sound like this stuff was going on today. No, it wasn't. It went on at the beginning of the century and was disbanded in 2003. And then President Trump quoted it like it was gospel or something. I thought it was a terrible piece of disinformation, as a matter of fact. And Netanyahu could produce no evidence that that Iran had violated the agreement. Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. As for the Ukraine, that they really don't want to be ruled by Putin. I don't believe it.
I don't think so. But I'm not sure I could trust the Ayatollahs in Iran.
Oh, I don't trust them either. That's why I said we got to free the world from Iranian, Russian, and Saudi oil. You take their petrodollars away from them, and suddenly they're overnight powerless.
Let's go to William in New Mexico, west of the Rockies. Hello, William. Good to have you with us.
Good to speak with you again, George.
Thank you, sir.
Just a question for your guest. Your analysis on. Have you heard of the Mosul to Haifa pipeline? It was shut down in about, I think, 1948 because of regional conflicts. But my analysis is that if the pipeline reopened, and I think there's a lot of interest in getting it reopened, it turns out that the portion of the pipeline cuts through Syria. And the U.S. owns a lot of the contracts in Mosul right now, and that would allow us to export that oil west without going through the Suez Canal and free up maybe some of our OPEC partners to export a little more of their oil east. And do you have any scan on that relative to what's going on in Syria? Because I feel like maybe a good portion of that's what's driving the conflict in Syria is they just don't want to let the Iraqi oil go through Syria.
The main problem with Syria is that it's a conflict that cannot burn itself out. That's what happens with most of these kinds of conflicts. You have these armies, a lot of them conflicting armies, a lot of them mercenary armies, a lot of them, you know, they're recruited. They're paid mercenaries, really, from other countries that go in there, and they're financed. One group is financed by the Saudis, another group financed by the Russians, another group is Iraqi. There's Turks in there, and the United States is pumping money into it. And these are this is a proxy civil war, where you have, you know, the Saudis, the United States, the Russians, we're all pumping money into it. So the war never goes bankrupt. They never run out of money, and they recruit people from different countries to go in there and do the fighting. And of course, the people that suffer are the Syrians. You know, it's the Syrian.
Oh, it's a devastation there. Horrible.
It's just completely unparalleled. It's a really horrible, horrible thing. And when people talk about the Sunni Shia split and schism conflict, it's really called what it is. No, it's a Saudi Iranian conflict. It's got nothing to do with the Islamic religion. The Saudis and the Iranians, they come up with a religious dogma in order to support this conflict, but it's just a geopolitical conflict. And then, you know, the Russians, they have their reasons for going into it. We want to support the Saudis. I have no idea why. So we go into it.
It's money, Bob. It's all about money.
Saudis. Oh, yeah. No. Yeah.
Let's go to Angola in Indiana. Tom's with us, first-time caller. Hey, Tom, go ahead.
I'd like to raise the question about energy because it seems to me that all of the world's geopolitical problems seem to revolve around energy, and everybody thinks of oil and gas. I wonder what your guests would think about the Chinese getting the jump on us on the thorium salt reactor.
I've done a lot of study of the thorium reactors, cold fusion, all that stuff. It's, you know, what's that one? The fusion reactor that you have to have a containment vessel that you're
you got to be able to contain it.
Energy. It's three times hotter than the surface of the sun, which is the hottest part of the sun. And, gee, I wonder why we've never come up with a containment vessel that can hold it. You know, at one point, South Korea was going to spend $1 trillion trying to create a fusion reactor. I mean, this is why we do these things. This is insane. What's the, you know, who cares? You know, the most expensive machine on the face of the earth? It's the Sheffield Nuclear Power Plant in England. It cost $35 billion. The only machine that's more expensive is the International Space Station, but that's in outer space. Why do we build these things? It's nuts. And nobody knows what to do with the spent fuel rods, which are, you know, which the world's producing in astronomical quantities of those every year. We'd have no idea at all what to do with them. And it's furthermore, it's too expensive. It's not only dangerous as hell, it's too expensive. You know, once every 12 years, you have a major meltdown of a nuclear power plant.
Yep, we sure do. Look in your crystal ball. Do you see a World War III?
I think what scares the hell out of me was, and it was the scenario of General Tommy Franks when he retired. As soon as the Army reached Baghdad, he retired. I never understood that one. Could you imagine Patton retiring after?
Yeah, right. We got there and we're done.
Yeah, after he took Messina and Sicily, could you imagine him retiring? But he retired, but he did say something interesting, and that was he said the scenario he fears, Jerry Purnell said, what's the scenario about? The scenario that Tommy Franks feared, and I think it's absolutely true. He said that, you know, after 9/11, we passed overnight, on 9/12, we passed the Patriot Act. It was in the can waiting, and we took away so many civil liberties. And it never could have passed that without 9/11. Just suppose you had a nuclear 9/11. That Tommy Frank said that the Congress and the American people would probably be so terrified, it would be unbearably frightening to have a city nuke. He said we'd probably surrender our authority, all the political authority of the Congress. We'd probably surrender to a despot. And after all, that's what the Romans did. That's what the French did with Napoleon. That's what Germans did with Hitler. That's what the Russians did first to Lenin and then to Putin when Putin blew up those housing complexes and then blamed it on the Chechens. And they handed over the reins of power. People forget that under Yeltsin, there had been a democracy in Russia.
For a short time.
Yeah, they had a surprising amount of freedom. And the if you look at the hard economic statistics, they were much more prosperous than they are now. Apparently, the Russian people... You know that they're enamored of Putin, but if you look at what they had under Yeltsin, they had more freedom and they had more prosperity, and the democracies, republics are shockingly fragile. You know the famous line that when Benjamin Franklin came out of the Constitutional Convention, and a woman came up to him and said, "What kind of government do we have, Mr. Franklin?" And he said, "A republic, if you can keep it." And they're terribly fragile. And also that there's an amazing book called How Democracies Die came out, and it said that, you know, democracies do die by their own hand, and that you get demagogic leaders who use the very institutions of this democracy to weaken and effectively neutralize the democratic, checks and balances. And they end up becoming despots through the processes of democracy.
Bob, we're going to take a break and come back with final phone calls with you in just a moment here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast, Bob Gleason with us. His website linked up at coasttocoastam.com. His book is called The Evil That Men Do. I can't tell you the end of the book. But does it end for people, Robert, in a good way?
It ends in a love scene, actually. I wanted to mention, I'm glad you said that we talk about all the interesting, somewhat scary information in the book, but it's also gotten extraordinary reviews. The book was called it a roiling in-your-face thriller, all narrated in a fiery prose that eagerly details love scenes, torture scenes, and the explosive finale. The Providence Journal said echoes the best of Tom Clancy, superb in all respects. Doug Preston, the number one New York Times bestseller, called it a pulse-pounding page-turner so hot it's on fire, wafted to us on updrafts from hell itself. The reader will have great fun. William Martin said, bombs away. Look out below. Run for cover. Gleason offends everybody. He might even offend you, but he'll entertain the hell out of you, too, at the same time. A verbal velocity that makes it impossible to put down, etc. So there's a lot of information in it. Some of it, it's all of it's interesting. Some of it's scary. But my goal was to entertain people and everybody.
Well, you did that. When do you have time to keep writing, doing all the other things you do with editing?
I love books. It's the real passion in my life, and I everything I do involves books. And you know, my wife and I made a decision not to have children. You know, I've been with the same woman for 54 years, and I don't play golf. I don't cut grass. I don't raise kids. I don't build ships and bottles.
You live in New York. There is no grass.
I know. One of the things I love about New York. But the book business is my life. I edit authors, and you know, I write books myself.
Let's go to the final callers. We will go to who's up next. Joe in Long Island. Go ahead, Joseph.
Yeah, hi, Bob. I have a couple of questions. Sure. My first one would be on the book itself. As you write a doomsday book, you do want the book to be well-reviewed, like the book you had. So I'm wondering if you go in mind where I don't want to take out everybody on the planet either, make it totally annihilation. I wonder how you come up with an angle that's going to maybe keep the readers interested. That'd be my first question. My second question would be relating the topic to the biblical prophecy. Now, people tend to look at the book of Revelation, but there's also something in Paul's letters where it says in the last days, and one of the people will be have these characteristics. One of it is in being insanely greedy, excessively greedy.
Absolutely.
Which you're kind of betraying people as in many cases.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering, you know, if we can look at on-the-ground behavior of people, like people seem to be over the top, insanely greedy. They could never even get to this pile of cash and do much with it with the time they have, the resources they have. If you're a billionaire, you can either climb Mount Kilimanjaro or you can't. It's either A or B. So it doesn't make a quantum leap in what you can or can't do with this money, but yet people live like it does.
That's a very. I'm glad you brought up the biblical prophecies. The book of Revelation is misunderstood because it's written out of chronology. The opening chapter is supposed to be chapter 13, and then an angel comes down to earth and he explains that God's going to destroy the world, and that he says there's too much greed. And you look at the greed today. That you, I mentioned that there were wealthy people 100 years ago, but they were also, and they did ruthless things, but they were also great men. They built the country. John D. Rockefeller refined the gasoline that powered the Industrial Revolution. Henry Ford built the automobiles. Fred Karam and those guys, they built the railroads. That Carnegie made the steel that built all that stuff. And they were great men. If you look at the kinds of men today, the super rich today, they make their money exploiting people in ways that have no redeeming social value. So many of them are hedge fund global derivative moguls. There's global debt derivatives that's pure intrinsic uncollateralized debt, and they chop it up into products and sell it to people that don't understand what they're buying. So many of these moguls, they make money off the internet, vanity enterprises, that they make money off of predatory casinos, that the hedge funds. It's not like the old days. And they do it just simply for money, for money's sake, just to pile up huge amounts of money. It really is straight out of the book of Revelation. And when that angel comes down, what the angel says to humanity is in Revelation, he says that uncontrollable greed is destroying humanity, that you're going to have a choice. You got to give up the greed. And the Antichrist, his power over humanity is he controls all the financial transactions. So the angel says you got to renounce the Antichrist, renounce your greed, or you'll spend all eternity in hellfire and damnation. That's where the phrase hellfire and damnation comes from. So that the a third of humanity says, can have money, hellfire and damnation, money, hellfire and damnation. I think I'll take the money anyway. And then the two-thirds of humanity actually does renounce its greed, and so they go into the city of God, and the rest of a third of humanity goes all the way into hell. And the if you look at the weapons that God uses on humanity, stars falling onto the earth. What is a nuclear weapon but a miniature man-made star detonating on the earth? Yeah. So many of the
plagues, a lot of symbolism.
Yeah, the plagues, the famines, all that stuff comes out of nuclear annihilation. That really, when you look at it, the nuclear weapons, they're all the horror and destruction of Revelation rolled up into single instruments. And the it's all the suffering of humanity rolled up into these miniature man-made stars.
There are
it
some
really
Robert,
is the fulfillment of Revelation.
Some believe that it has already happened a long time ago, that we annihilated ourselves the same way.
Oh yeah, there's a lot of the ancient Indian verse epics, you know, describe these wars that went on 10,000 years ago.
All right, let's go back to the calls. John in Ohio, take it away, John.
Hey, hi there.
Hey, good to have you.
I had a question about, I haven't heard many people talking about it, but China recently made it possible for other countries to purchase oil using their currency. I was wondering what kind of effect that will have on the petrodollar.
My understanding is that the virtual currencies are being used, primarily by terrorist groups, by the international mafia.
The hackers.
Yeah, the hackers, and that it's extremely volatile. It has very volatile swings up and down, and it's people that if you want to conceal money, and if you want to do financial transactions where it's very very difficult to follow the money. The cryptocurrencies, are a good way to do it. And by the way, George, one last time I want to mention my website, robertgleasonbooks.com. Gleason is Gleason. Thank you.
That's all right. Let's go. How long have you had that website, by the way?
It had been called the nuclearterrorist.com.
That's right.
But I changed it to, I had a nonfiction book called The Nuclear Terrorist as Financial Backers and Political Patrons in the U.S. and Abroad. But when I got... I have a lot of books out, and I decided I would, I would put them all under one umbrella, robertgleasonbooks.com.
Let's go to Vincent in Alabama. Hi, Vincent. Go ahead, sir.
Good morning.
Morning.
Hi. Well, I've been listening to you about all the gas prices and everything. Why can't they just go ahead and level it all and stop prices jumping up all the time?
Greed. They make too much money.
Well, you said level it all, were you talking about the Middle East or when? Or
Middle East, but back here in the U.S., gas prices jump all over the place.
Yeah, level off the prices, not the land, Robert.
Yeah.
Why can't they do that?
Level the prices?
Yeah, just keep them even.
It is, prices tend to be based somewhat on supply and demand, and if you reduce the demand for oil, then the prices drop down. You know, the real reason that the Soviet Union went under was that in the 80s, for a variety of reasons, price of oil dropped down.
Yeah, they got squeezed.
Yeah, it was down to like $8 a barrel, and basically the Soviet economy went bust. And and if we could like reduce the price of oil again, we'd put Putin out of business. We wouldn't have to worry about the Saudis bankrolling. Saudis have bankrolled most of the terrorism and the Islamist terrorism in the world. We wouldn't have to worry about the Saudis bankrolling terrorists. Most of the problems would be, and we wouldn't have to worry about the air pollution. We wouldn't have to worry about climate change. Most of the problems that we're facing would be radically diminished.
Do the Saudis bankroll terrorism to keep them out of their country?
Yeah, that's the deal they've cut with them. They'll cut them checks as long as they don't practice terrorism in their country. It was after the takeover of the mosque, the Grand Mosque in
Mecca.
1979, they made that unholy alliance. They did that unholy alliance, and they cut that deal with bin Laden, that they would continue to send him, you know, millions of dollars a year if he would hole up in Pakistan or Afghanistan.
Back to Syria, though, but Assad's father was a butcher. I'm not sure this guy was as bad. What do you hear about him?
He's done just, you know, horrible, horrible things. But I have to say, and I'm not defending Assad at all, the big problem with the conflict in Syria is this isn't Syrians fighting Syrians. You know, it's these proxy armies that are financed by major powers, wealthy powers, and they bring in all kinds of, soldiers from other countries, and they're fighting away. And there's like four different countries that are bankrolling this war.
Why do they want him out so much?
Lord knows Assad is a monster, and but they haven't been able to defeat him.
I'm not sure he's the one who used chemical weapons on his own people. Do you?
I haven't seen how much evidence there is on that. I haven't really looked at the evidence. On the other hand, that if you look at all the unimaginable quantities of bombs and shells and bullets and stuff, does it really matter if you're blown up by a bomb or if you're gone, you're gone. Yeah, you're gassed with chlorine. What about all the other stuff that's that all sides? How about the bombs that the Saudis have financed? How about the bombs we financed? The Russians, the Syrians,
the Chinese,
nobody's hands are clean, and we're doing none of this to help the Syrian people. But nobody's motives are pure. Everybody's the Iranians are trying to. The Iranians are really, trying to fight the Saudis, and they're using Syria as a battleground. And we've decided to help the Saudis, and the Russians have decided to help the Iranians and the Syrians. And nobody's got clean motives in this.
Shelley in Long Island, New York, east of the Rockies. Hi, Shelley.
Salutations, gentlemen. I thought you could touch on the Balfour Agreement and how Rothschild just delegated, or the Queen delegated Israel, and how they took over and segregated, and also how much money they make in gold, buying and selling, the commissions, and how wealthy they are. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Oh, okay. Well, we're coming up on 70 years, aren't we?
Yeah.
70 years.
She talked about the Balfour Declaration and that.
That formed Israel.
Israel was created. It was largely... nobody really wanted the creation of Israel. And Stalin had, there had been, several studies. The English had done several studies that said that, if there was an independent Israel, that there would be nonstop war, internecine warfare, pretty much in perpetuity. It was a prediction that was shockingly accurate. And but Stalin had some implicit belief, it was turned out to be fallacious, but he thought the Jews had an affinity for communism, and he thought, and also he thought he was wrong. Yeah, he was completely wrong, and he had a but he thought that they would have a beachhead in the Middle East, and so he really promoted the creation of Israel at the UN. Now that there were only two powers that counted in the UN, it was Russia back then. Everyone else had been pretty much wiped out.
And us.
And so the United States and Russia really dominated the UN. Truman hadn't really had much interest in creating the State of Israel, but he didn't want Stalin to have a beachhead. But also, he needed the Jewish vote at home, particularly to win New York State. He was going to run against a very popular New York governor, Tom Dewey. And he was, and Clark Clifford told him that
said Dewey wins. Remember?
Yeah, and Clark Clifford told Truman. He said that if you want to win the 48 election, you better support the State of Israel. So for both domestic politics and foreign politics, Truman decided he'd support the State of Israel. And of course, those British studies turned out to be incredibly accurate. There's been nonstop warfare in Israel ever since.
It's been
and it goes on to this day, and I see no end of it.
They should have carved out a place for the Palestinians immediately, Robert, at the same time.
Yeah, and the whole thing is, I have, you know, I try not to comment on the Israeli-Palestinian politics. I've never.
No, I get it. You can't win.
I don't really know. I'm not. I have no.
Not your expertise, my friend.
I have no glib answers. Well, it's also I don't. I've never heard anybody come up with an easy answer for that.
There is no easy answer. No. Get your website out for us one more time. Go ahead.
Thank you. RobertGleasonBooks.com. Gleason is GLEASON, and the book is The Evil That Men Do, and it's, everybody says it's a pulse pounding page thriller.
Thank you, Robert. Always a great guest, and you're a great editor. We love you. We will be back in a moment as I talk with Ross Rosenberg about the human magnet syndrome. This is an incredible story, and that's next for you on Coast to Coast AM, so don't touch your dial.